We're going to turn now to a different and yet still Trump-based inquiry. This time, it's about Donald Trump and his lawyers, as in what he wants his lawyers to do all day. This is a question that's taken on real salience, actually, this week, as a former adult film star, Stormy Daniels, has really tied us up in knots for days on end as she fights to get out from under a non-disclosure agreement about a relationship she says she had with the president that the White House is simultaneously denying and also trying to enforce. So I thought it would be a good idea to talk to Bob Bauer about the wonderful world of lawyers, in part because he wrote about it this week in Lawfare, and also because his article was a bracing reminder to me that the president's lawyers actually have norms and rules, and we may have forgotten that. So I want to welcome to the show Bob Bauer. He served as White House counsel to President Obama, returned to private practice in 2011. In 2013, President Obama named him to be co-chair of the Presidential Commission on Election Administration. He's written numerous books about campaign finance and elections law, and he's on the faculty now at NYU Law School. He's also a contributing editor of Lawfare. He writes legal commentary for Just Security. And so, Bob, I think I want you just to explain to me the way White House counsel thinks about, or former White House counsel thinks about White House counsel, and then just these norms around what government lawyers do and don't do and the ways in which they've collapsed. And I thought maybe we could start with the very basic question of what does White House counsel do all day? And how is it different from the other lawyers who are in the president's orbit, whether it's, you know, the OLC, the attorney general, his personal lawyers? What does White House counsel look like?
White House counsel represents the executive office of the presidency, or to, you know, put it more simply, he represents the presidency. Now, of course, he's appointed to the position by a particular president with a particular program. And so in some respects, it's impossible to say that the White House counsel doesn't represent the particular president who appointed him and whom he or she serves on a day-to-day basis. But he's a government lawyer. And so speaking now with someone like Don McGahn, his obligation is to represent the institution. And that's tricky because, as I said a minute ago, he represents an individual who almost certainly thinks of himself. Most presidents think of themselves as the client. And yet he has to balance the responsiveness to that particular person who considers himself the client against his overall obligation as a government lawyer to the institution of the presidency. He's a government attorney. He represents the interests of the public. So that builds in a certain amount of tension. You mentioned the Office of Legal Counsel in the Justice Department. Well, the Office of Legal Counsel discharges functions on delegated authority from the Attorney General. They're Justice Department lawyers, and they provide advice to the executive branch, binding advice to the executive branch on a whole range of issues. And there again, while the head of OLC is nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate, the individual lawyers in the OLC are hired by the OLC leadership. All of them are obligated to consider themselves government lawyers who, on the one hand, have that internal client, like the attorney general or, you know, the particular administration they serve, but they have also an overriding obligation to consider the long-range interests of the institution.
So can you give me an example, just a really concrete example of historically how that tension manifests? I mean, how do you find yourself if you are White House counsel in a situation where the interests of the president and the office of the president are not aligned?
Here's an example, and I'm picking it because it's sort of so outlandish in some respects. It's both entertaining and it underscores the point I think you want me to make. When John Dean was President Nixon's White House counsel, he was looking to define the office a certain way. He was very young, and he was apparently anxious to establish a presence for the White House counsel. So he was looking, if you will, to sort of fill out its portfolio. He wrote a memorandum in which he talked about various functions the White House counsel could perform, most of which, for example, you know, helping provide clearances for executive branch appointments are fairly standard and continue to this day. But he also volunteered the White House counsel's support for the enterprise of looking into the backgrounds of potential opponents to President Nixon in his reelection campaign in 1972. Now, that was very important to President Nixon, But the White House counsel doesn't function as a support to the president in his political capacity. He doesn't function as a support to the president in his personal capacity. He functions in support of the president and advises the president solely in his official capacity.
But that requires a president who understands the difference between his personal attorney and his divorce attorney and his White House counsel and his attorney general. And I think one of the things that you wrote this week that was striking to me was this is a president who just really, I think, maybe in part because he comes up through New York real estate, but he just wants all his attorneys to be the guy who just fixes stuff, right?
Yes. As far as I can tell, and I think there's a decent amount of evidence to support this view, the president views the lawyers as he views every single other member of his staff, which is individuals who are supposed to deliver the goods. They're supposed to give him the answer that he wants, clear away the obstacles he doesn't want to have to deal with. And in that sense, you know, he wants, to put it in his crudest terms, he wants yes people in that job. Now, you know, I'm not saying he never listens to a lawyer. I suppose that, you know, if a lawyer were to say to him, if you do X, you're almost certainly going to land in jail for the rest of your life, you know, the president might pay attention to that. But overall, the sense that you have is that the president doesn't have any appreciation of the professional responsibility of the lawyer to advise. First of all, as an independent professional, which means just by definition, the lawyer can't give the president what he wants. It's not bona fide legal advice if it's tailor-made to the president's wishes. And secondly, if the lawyer doesn't appreciate that institutional role that I was talking about just a minute ago, that he's not there just to serve Donald Trump. He's there to assist with the Trump presidency and to represent the presidency as an institution. Now, let me just stress again, there's some balance to be struck. I mean, certainly the White House counsel, like the lawyers at the Office of Legal Counsel, as very good lawyers, would be looking for opportunities to provide legal channels for the president to do what he was elected to do. That's legitimate. But there are limits. And you mentioned the word limits previously, and it's precisely limits that I think this president has a huge amount of trouble with.
Yeah. And I think you teased it out in your column really effectively when you compared the ways Michael Cohen, the president's personal lawyer, kind of couldn't say no when he was asked to deflect and lie for the president. And that Don McGahn, when he was asked to, you know, put out a false statement about the possible firing that he was evidently asked to participate in, that he actually wouldn't lie to the president. Is that a function of who those people are, or is that a function of their role as lawyers? One is a sort of personal lawyer for the president, and one who answers at some level to the responsibilities of being White House counsel. Maybe that's not a fair question, but clearly one can lie.
Yeah, fair enough. Without speaking, you know, to sort of how Michael Cohen views his job, because I don't know Michael Cohen, I would say, as far as one can tell, the problem occurs on two levels. The first is that even a lawyer to someone in their personal capacity has to draw certain limits, has to be prepared to say no, has in the end to adhere to a certain standard of independence and professionalism. So that's one core concern any lawyer, even in a personal capacity, would have to have. And then the second problem is managing the pressures from somebody who doesn't understand the role of a lawyer and not yielding, if you will, to the demands from that client for sort of a yes answer. I suppose the two points I'm making are roughly the same. In McGahn's case, you know, he has the additional requirement, if you will, he has to meet the additional requirement of being a public servant. And that's what he is. Michael Cohen isn't, although I would say again, I just want to repeat this so I'm very clear about this, even as a personal lawyer, it's not as if Cohen is entitled to throw everything out the window to get the president what he wants. The canon of ethics certainly call on lawyers to be zealous in the representation of their clients, but there are canons, there are ethical limits, even on the zealousness of the representation, on the lengths to which lawyers will go to satisfy their client.
Is this, in the end, just a function of it has historically been the case, and certainly in your lifetime it's been the case, that the lawyers who take positions in the executive branch, in the Justice Department, just know the culture. They know the drill. And then when you get people like Michael Cohen in there who are just like, no, this is the way we've always done it. I mean, is it just a failure of DC culture to make itself known to the wider world? Or is there something? I find myself constantly baffled that this is not sort of learnable or teachable, that there are lawyers in the world who just think this is all these DC norms are silly. Am I wrong?
I don't think you're wrong. I think you're putting your finger, particularly with respect to the White House counsel's office, on a very important vulnerability. And I contrast it for this purpose with the Office of Legal Counsel in the Department of Justice. You know, there you do have an institution that has, I think, a developed culture. The White House counsel is at close quarters with the president. It's a very personal position in one sense. The president appoints the White House counsel. The White House counsel is not, of course, confirmed by the Senate. And he or she is one floor above the first floor where the Oval Office is located and is back and forth on a day-to-day basis, addressing the needs that the president has for legal advice or that the senior staff has. And so do I believe there's a consistent set of norms that have been established that all White House counsels clearly understand? No. I think probably there isn't enough of one. And then the second consequence of that is that in the absence of those norms, what becomes extraordinarily important is the temperament, the character, and the expectation of the president himself. And in that situation, if the president has the inclination to view lawyers the way I believe Donald Trump views them and the way he views the rest of his staff, then I think that if you take that together with the sorts of problems with the absence of a completely developed culture around the office, that can lead to very, very serious problems.
I wonder if there was a line in your piece that I've been thinking about the last couple of days, and I'm just going to read it to you because I think I'm going to ask you to unpack it. And the line is, you say, Trump's attitude toward law and his use and abuse of lawyers are distinguishing features of his presidency, which may well help bring it down. While prosecutors like Robert Mueller investigate crimes and not people, they also consider whether the individuals who come within their sight in the course of an investigation have illicit intent or motive. Character unavoidably enters in this judgment. By now, it is clear to the special counsel, among others, that this president has a purely instrumental view of lawyers and the law. Now, that's what you've been saying. You know, character matters. It matters the tone with which the president views the lawyers. Are you saying that at some point Mueller is going to start looking at these people who are not playing within the boundaries of the rules and the norms of how things are done and looking askance at them because they have an obligation, even in the absence of the president wanting them to perform on that obligation? Are you saying that Mueller is looking? I guess I'm curious about whose character Mueller's looking at this moment.
It's impossible, you know, to think about this without obviously putting Donald Trump at the center of all of it. I mean, so I really had in mind Donald Trump.
Okay.
And Donald Trump's behavior toward lawyers, his apparent attitude toward the law. And clearly, you know, to the extent that Mueller's investigating actions by Donald Trump, he's investigating actions and he's looking at the facts that raise questions about whether the actions comply with the law. But of course, in every case, you know, there's a question of, you know, intent. You know, was there willfulness? Was there mens rea? Was there clearly intent to engage in misconduct of the specified kind that he's looking at? And over time, I think it's inevitable. It's certainly been my experience in private practice. You know, prosecutors develop a picture of the person whose conduct is being investigated. And when the time comes to think about those questions of intent, if you will, to make the close calls, to try to decide between version A and version B, you know, particularly the version that the suspect or target is pressing upon the prosecutor, that picture becomes relevant. It shades or colors in some way how they're going to interpret the behavior of the person whose actions they're investigating. What we have is a president who has just count the ways, you know, berated his and indeed had his White House counsel threatened for not lying publicly about whether or not he'd been given an order to fire Bob Mueller. We have a president who's publicly berated his attorney general for complying with the requirement that he recuse himself under DOJ regulations from the Russia investigation. We have a president who has openly pressured his attorney general to undertake investigations into his 2016 political opponent, Hillary Clinton. So you have a president whose respect for law is, I'll put it kindly, very much in doubt, whose view of the law is very instrumental. And it's just hard to see how in a case where the president's motives and intent are inevitably going to be presented, that this isn't going to work very much against him in the final assessment by prosecutors.
Is the simpler way of saying what you've just said that at some level, Bob Mueller is tasked with defending the rule of law, defending the notion that law matters and that lawyers do what lawyers do, and that in some fashion that is also part of the mandate, is that just he is tasked with, because no one else can serve as the rule of law backstop, that he is going to be thinking this president, who is purely transactional about the law, that this stands for something when he pushes back? Is that what you're saying?
As a special counsel whose investigation concerns the president and close aides and family members of the president, it's going to be, of course, very important that Mueller, set aside subjective impressions and the like and stay focused on the law and the evidence. He's a consummate professional. That's what he'll try to do. But on the other hand, on the flip side of what I just said, he is looking at conduct by individuals who hold the positions of the highest public responsibility in the United States, and in particular the president. And will that enter into how he thinks what his obligation here is in making final decisions about what happened, what's chargeable and what's not? And I'm setting aside the question of whether he will agree that the president can be indicted while in office. I don't know how he's going to come down on that issue, but I do think, to answer your question squarely, that concern with this investigation and the legacy of this investigation, if you will, as a vindication of the rule of law, has to weigh somewhat in the way the special counsel's team thinks about what their work is.
So that's a great segue to the last thing I wanted to add. There are 100 things I want to ask you, but I'm going to ask you this and then have you come back to talk about other things. You talked in your piece about Leonard Garment. He was Richard Nixon's longtime political associate. He eventually becomes a member of the legal defense team in Watergate, and he advises Nixon. And you talk about him deciding to stay on because he thinks of Nixon at this point is a quote, extraordinary leader and a friend. And it led me to ask you to reflect a little bit on the question I often ask people who've served in government, which is, how do you balance the tension between your love of this office, your dedication to the executive branch, your dedication to this person, maybe a little bit of a side of also, I think I'm here mitigating damages. If I leave, it's going to be worse because Omarosa is going to become the president's legal advisor. How do you balance all these things? And I guess my question is, there is this line, and I've been trying to find it for a year, between staying on because you value this president, you value the work, because you value the office and you really are, in your view, bolstering this office, and then sliding into colluding with something that is, I think the legal term is bananas. And so I guess I want to ask you to reflect, maybe through the prism of Leonard Garment, staying on and advising Nixon, but also I think we started this conversation about, this is about loyalty to an office. How do you sort of slip and slide your way through that tension when you genuinely believe, as I suspect a lot of people who have stayed on in good faith genuinely believe, that they're doing that because of some higher calling?
Yes, and it'd be very easy for people, particularly if they love the job and if they have believed at some point in the person they're serving, it'd be very difficult for people to deal with that issue. I'm sure it's not easy. We're all human. I suppose the term that comes to mind and the the trap you wouldn't want to fall into is the term enabler and the trap of becoming an enabling party. So in other words, at some point, a lawyer has to be very honest with himself or herself and ask the question, am I, by hanging on, actually accomplishing something that is productive and consistent both with the interests of the institution and with my professional responsibility, or have I become an enabler? Am I simply here, you know, 75% of the time to basically allow something I don't approve of to go on, that I shouldn't approve on to go on, that's inconsistent with the public interest to go on, even if, you know, 25% of the time I periodically express some concern, I take the White House chief of staff aside and I tell him I'm worried about it, and then I let it drop if nothing happens. So I satisfy myself that I've expressed my concerns, you know, that I have given effect to my conscience by just, by and large, for the record, now and then being worried about something and being open that I'm open that I'm worried about something. But then I just go on with an institution, with an arrangement, with a culture, and with frankly, an employer who is engaged in activities that I, as a lawyer, should not be enabling. And that's a very hard issue to face. Where it really collapses, I think, in the White House is if the White House itself, because I spoke of culture earlier, itself suffers from a rancid culture. So that not only do I have the problem that I have with the president, but I have nowhere else to turn, no other allies in the building like the chief of staff to bolster my efforts to maintain a professional posture toward the president. And, you know, if a lawyer, you know, looks at all of that and recognizes that the role has become fundamentally an enabling role, then I honestly don't believe that he or she can defend staying there any longer. I don't know the facts right now of the different wars that the current White House counsel has fought, how many he's won that we don't hear about, how many he's lost that we do hear about. So I don't know what his batting average is. I don't know how much support he's getting with what success from elsewhere in the building. But I think those are the questions that obviously I'd be surprised if he wasn't asking himself. And I think that at the end of the day, that's what lawyers cannot ultimately be and remain good lawyers. They cannot become their clients' enablers.
Bob Bauer served as White House counsel under President Obama. In 2013, the president named him to be co-chair of the Presidential Commission on Election Administration. He's written multiple books on campaign finance law, elections law, and is on the faculty at NYU Law School. He's also a contributing editor of Lawfare and Rights for Just Security, all indispensable in this moment. And thank you so much, Bob, for giving us a little bit of your time.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.